Today, on the exam room.
People have come to look at the microbiome, not of the gut, of the brain. Researchers found people who take antivirals could reduce the risk of developing Alzheimer's by 90% or more.
Welcome to the Exam Room Podcast, brought to you by the Physicians Committee. Hi, I'm the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll, raising health IQs coast to coast and around the world. Hi to the exam roomies listening in Baltimore, Maryland, Renton, Washington, and Nottingham, England. Wherever you are, we appreciate you helping to make the world a healthier place. This is episode 8 of season 8, number 607 overall. You know, we talk a lot about gut microbiome here on the show, but today we're going to introduce you to another type of microbiome, brain microbiome. And just like the microbiome in your gut, the microbiome in your brain, it's like a community of microorganisms that live there. They're living rent-free, some of them helping you, some of them maybe even harming you. And Dr. Neil Barnard is back with us today to introduce you to brand new research showing that this emerging area of scientific exploration, the brain microbiome, what role it plays in brain disorders, including Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Now, these findings come on the heels of new projections that forecast the number of people living with dementia in the United States will double by the year 2060, and that more than 1 million new cases of dementia will be diagnosed every single year thereafter. So today's conversation really could not come at a better time. Also today, the connection between Alzheimer's disease and vaccinations. Very surprising data there, plus your diet and the risk of dementia. Huge connection there. Specifically, we're going to be delving into antioxidants and the protections that they offer, and ditto for omega-3s and berries and anthocyanins. And how a little bit of exercise can go a long way also in preventing Alzheimer's. So all of that and a lot more as we look into a potential breakthrough to stay sharp-minded well into our golden years. But first, our Food for Life program is accepting applications for new instructors. This is very exciting because we're only doing one round of training this year. So this is your one and only opportunity to get Food for Life certified in 2025. You can turn your passion into a career, or at the very least, really help school your community when it comes to nutrition. Now, Food for Life is the Physicians Committee's longest standing nutrition program and has been providing individuals with the knowledge and the tools for plant-based eating for 23 years. 23 years. And isn't it about time that you join our family at Food for Life? This is an 8-week instructor's course online to get your certification. And applications, though, they must be received before February 7th. Visit fftraining.org to apply. That is fftraining.org, or click the link in the episode notes. Now then, let's talk about brand new research in the fight against Alzheimer's. Here now, Dr. Neil Barnard talking brain microbiome and a lot more from the Exam Room Live.
Thanks for being here, my friend.
Great to be here, Chuck.
Alzheimer's research is desperately needed. So when you approached me and you said, hey, we've got new things to talk about, I got excited for one. What are those new things that we should be talking about today?
You know, there's bad news, there's good news. Bad news is that the search for the magic pill is not there yet. Just this past week, we had two candidate drugs. They looked really promising. You give them to people and they do nothing. They crash, they burn, that's hundreds of millions of dollars wasted, gone. But we have new evidence that foods are going to be helpful. And out of absolute left field, people have come to look at the microbiome, not of the gut, of the brain. That in our brain, it's not just brain cells up there. You might have a viral infection of your brain. Could that be possible? I guess people have gotten used to this in other ways. You know that, okay, you're out in the sun, a little bit too much sun, and you get a cold sore. That's a herpes virus in the skin or in the nerves that go through the skin, and they erupt. So these viruses move around, and researchers have discovered that the viruses can mess with your brain a little bit. And the headline is that researchers found that people who take antivirals, simple antiviral drugs, the very same things that a person would take for a cold sore or any other kind of herpetic infection, could reduce the risk of developing Alzheimer's by 90% or more. Now, when that came out, people did a complete double take to think, could it be as simple as that? And the answer is a definite maybe. The beauty of this is that the antivirals are they have virtually no side effects.
Right.
So I'm talking about a drug like acyclovir, for example. Go to any CVS, any drugstore, people are picking it up because they got a herpes infection or something like that. They have other uses too. And you look at the list of side effects, and there's really nothing there, nothing that's really very common. And apparently when people take them for a while, their risk of developing Alzheimer's goes way, way, way down. Now, that's the headline.
Okay.
Cautions. Couple scientific cautions. The first is that doing this research is hard. And there are a lot, it tends to be sort of retrospective. Like we're looking back at people who took it. And is a person who took it, could they have other differences than people who have it? All that's possible. But for right now, it's so promising because there's no risk, or effectively no risk, and a lot of benefit. Okay, that's thing one.
All right.
Thing two, related to it. How do you prevent an infection of this type? Well, people take vaccines for all kinds of things, Chuck, as you know. You get your flu shot, you get your shingles vaccine, a COVID vaccine, you get a measles vaccine, all kinds of things. And researchers discovered that the more people get certain vaccines, the lower their risk of developing Alzheimer's. Now, vaccines, I don't need to tell you, double-edged sword. I mean, if you look at polio, the polio vaccine knocked out polio to a very substantial degree. But vaccines also have risks. We saw, 30 years ago when I was in medical school, vaccine came out that caused Guillain-Barré syndrome. Really serious nerve effects. So they have benefit, they have risks. But what researchers seem to have found is that the flu vaccine, you took it to prevent the flu. Shingles vaccine, you took it to prevent a shingles attack. But when people get these specific vaccines, the risk of Alzheimer's is reduced as well.
Interesting.
So now, before people race out to the store and say, all right, I wasn't sure if I was going to get my vaccine this year, but I'm going to roll up my sleeve because it might just help me. We still are not sure exactly which vaccines seem to be in this category, if any. But the ones that people are really looking at are influenza vaccines, shingles vaccines, and probably the pneumonia vaccines as well. The COVID vaccines, a source of eternal controversy.
Absolutely.
And I, to tell you the truth, Chuck, I think rightly so. I think it's a reasonable thing that they have been controversial because, first of all, COVID killed 1 million people in the United States the first year it came out. Serious thing. And I'm quite prepared to believe that the vaccines were a huge shot in the arm to reducing the risk. That said, there are risks, some of them significant, to the coronavirus vaccines. And I think they have to be taken seriously, particularly since the virus itself seems to be less malignant than it was in the first wave. So stay tuned. So two headlines. Could antivirals actually reduce the risk of Alzheimer's? The best science we have says, yeah, dramatically. But there are not enough studies yet to say that with a huge amount of confidence. And could vaccines reduce the risk? The best science we have says, yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. I guess my first question is, as long as we're sitting on this hot seat and talking about vaccines, why not just dive all the way in? How do these other vaccines, the ones that have been showing promise, the one for shingles, for flu, how do they differ from the COVID vaccine? We've heard a lot about this term, you know, it goes in there and it messes with the mRNA. So right. How do these others operate differently?
Yeah, exactly. An mRNA vaccine is really a completely different kind of vaccine. The old fashioned vaccines, everything before that, you're giving either a killed virus or an attenuated virus, and your body is mounting a response to that virus. And why these vaccines work? Short answer, we don't know. Longer answer, what we think is happening is that it causes the body to have a stronger immune reaction to not just the target virus, but perhaps other viruses too.
And then my other question is, what do we know in terms of, could Alzheimer's itself be caused by a virus if these antivirals are working? A lot of people think that, okay, well, it may be dietarily driven, it may be genetics, it may be trauma to the brain. Mm-hmm. You know, none of those things necessarily would create a virus inside the body. So why might the antivirals show so much promise?
Right, exactly. It's sort of the blind men and the elephant. Each person is trying to feel their way through to see what the answer really is. What we think, well, the amyloid hypothesis has really been the dominant hypothesis, and I think there's still a lot to it. There are people ready to throw it out. I think that's premature. But beta amyloid accumulates in the brain, and Dr. Alzheimer himself first saw that and said, this is a dementing condition. So the first thought was, well, if the amyloid is building up, that's what's causing the damage. So then a newer theory is, well, wait, maybe the amyloid protein is building up in response to something. Maybe the body is trying to defend itself against viruses, and the amyloid is there to try to swallow up those viruses and take them away. Right. So people are trying to make the data fit, and I think that's not an unreasonable hypothesis.
All right. But at the top, you also mentioned that there was perhaps some new data as well with food. Is that another good news, bad news situation?
It is.
Okay.
A little bit of history. Back in 2003, the Chicago Health and Aging Project came out with some amazing information. They went around Chicago, recruited people, looked at their diets, and looked who stayed mentally clear and who developed Alzheimer's. And they found the first thing was that people who avoided bad fat, you're avoiding saturated fat, which is in dairy and meat and so forth. People who avoided saturated fat, pretty much, had about 2/3 less risk of Alzheimer's compared to the other people. People who ate a lot of saturated fat had substantially higher risk. Okay, so that's important. So then people started saying, well, you know, if that's the case, then there ought to be benefit to diet patterns that generally avoid saturated fat. So take a Mediterranean diet, for example. If people have a Mediterranean diet, what's the main fat? It's olive oil. So olive oil has monounsaturated fat, doesn't have a lot of saturated fat. But by the way, little trick, saturated fat in a jar, solid at room temperature. Polyunsaturated fat in a jar, liquid at room temperature and in your fridge. And the way you could tell that the monounsaturated fat, like in olive oil, is that it's liquid on your shelf, solid in the fridge. So anyhow, a little trick you can try at home. You don't need a laboratory. You can tell them just by that.
That's science, my friends.
There you go. Okay, yeah. So anyhow, what happened? The Mediterranean diets did seem to be associated with reduced risk of Alzheimer's. That's good. But it only worked if it was an observational study. You just looked at people who were doing their own lives, and the people who followed a more Mediterranean pattern had less risk of Alzheimer's. So Martha Claire Morris, who had been the head of the Chicago Health and Aging Project, said, let's do a serious, real test. And she brought in people and she said, half of you in Chicago go on a Mediterranean type diet. Let's actually do it in your life. And the other half not. And as the years went by, what happened was nothing. There was no benefit to people adopting that diet, which is to say that people seemed maybe modestly better because they were in the study, they were paying attention, but that was true for the control group as well as the other group. So it crashed and burned. The New England Journal published her article, and the honesty of this research team was admirable, but it just did not work. That doesn't mean that the original finding was wrong.
Right.
What it seems to mean is that the diet didn't go far enough. If I tell a group of people, let's go Mediterranean, how do they interpret that in the U.S.? They don't interpret that meaning, throw out the meat. They say, well, maybe a little bit less meat and have some olive oil all over my salad and have some chicken and some fish and some cheese. The diet changes are so modest, they don't really get you to where you need to be. So Dr. Dean Ornish comes in, who had already shown that with throwing the meat out completely, you can reverse heart disease. And he did the same for prostate cancer, pretty much, that you can change the course of prostate cancer. Brought in people, over 50 people, who had early stages of Alzheimer's disease. They had cognitive loss already. And he brings them in and he takes all the meat out of their diet, all the dairy out of their diet, and the oils too, really. It was not a Mediterranean sort of semi-diet. It was vegan diet. And he got them exercising. You know, they're lacing up their sneakers and they're exercising. And he also gave them a number of supplements, things like vitamin C and multivitamins and some omega-3s too. And what he found was that in the control group that didn't do that, they did what people with Alzheimer's do, which is they worsen over time. The people who did this, in 70% of cases, they stabilized or got better. And we have never had a study showing that with any kind of dietary intervention. And it was astounding. And so my interpretation is, you're talking about a death sentence when you're talking about Alzheimer's disease.
Yes.
Because you lose everyone and everything that ever mattered to you. But when people make these changes, which end up being not as complicated as people imagine going into it, going for a walk every day, getting your heart beating a little bit, eating healthy foods, that you could stabilize this disease. And in some cases, even improve it so that a person who, I remember my grandmother saying, when I get to the end of the paragraph, I can't remember the beginning anymore. Mm. I don't want to read anymore. It's too frustrating for me. People find that no longer happens to them, that their brain is coming back. Now, we don't know what happens 2 years, 3 years down the line. Will we continue to be able to hold this off? We don't know, but his study did show that for some people, at least, you can push this disease back, which I think is a great thing.
That kind of gives me hope that maybe in our lifetime, even, this disease won't be that death sentence that it has been. I think about a disease completely different, HIV and AIDS. I mean, you talk about getting that in the 70s and 80s, death sentence. It's not that way any longer. And so to hear Dr. Ornish's research show to that extent, 70% is a huge number.
Yes.
That to me gives me a lot of hope for where we can go as we continue to research this and try to find the cure. I think that that's a phenomenal step, a great path that we're on.
Absolutely. And to get into the weeds a little bit more, I asked Dr. Ornish about that 70%. And he said, look at it this way. There were really three groups. There are people who continued to get worse. That was about 30% of that group. continued to get worse. And then about another 30% or so, just the disease was sort of arrested right in place. And about 40% were getting better. So I said, well, what's the difference between those groups? And the difference, Chuck, was whether they followed the regimen. In other words, if you follow the regimen, those people tended to get better. If you sort of followed it, you could kind of arrest the disease, but maybe not get a lot better. And if you said, well, it's my birthday, maybe I should go out and have the pepperoni pizza just today.
Yeah.
Or it's raining out, I don't think I want to go exercise. And if you just sort of don't do it, then the disease comes in and just takes over. But when people really do these things, by and large, they're better. And I have to say, when he told me that, I remembered back, it was 1990, he published this with heart disease. Same thing, 82% of people got better. 18% did not. And when you look at those 18%, it was the people who, for the most part, weren't following the regimen exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to say that a regimen like this is always going to work great, and it's just a question of, do you follow it? That's generally true, but there are going to be people who follow a really good diet and genetics or something else becomes overwhelming. These things do happen, but let's line it up. Let's use the things that can help us.
I think that's really important information. I didn't realize that, you know, that it wasn't necessarily a 30% failure. You could look at it half empty or 70% full and 30% empty, but that 30% could actually, you know, we could be looking at, if everybody followed it, 80-20, 90-10, something like that, which is even more exciting than the 70-30 that we have right now. That's just extraordinary, and it just goes to show, like, the importance of leading that healthier lifestyle, eating those healthier foods. And I notice, and I hope that a lot of people also picked up on this, you mentioned going for a walk as opposed to that daunting, you know, 5K a day kind of mentality. Going for a walk is something that virtually everyone can do. Just get out, lace up the sneakers, take a stroll.
Oh, they can. Dr. Erickson, who spoke at our ICNM this last year, did a brilliant, brilliant study. He brought in people who had sort of the beginnings of memory issues, their memory sputtering a little bit. He said, do this. Put on your sneakers, 10-minute walk. And it was a brisk walk. So a brisk means it's not a trudge. It's fast enough that your pulse is increasing a little bit, but not so fast that you can't speak easily. That's a good brisk walk. 10 minutes, three times a week. Now, week two, it's a 15-minute walk, three times. Week three, you add another 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got them up to 40 minutes, brisk walk, three times a week, he said, stay at that level. And a year later, he did brain scans on everybody, and the hippocampus had expanded back. Yes.
Wow.
The hippocampus is the seat of memory, and it had been shrinking in these people. That's what you typically see on autopsy. It was re-expanding, and their performance on memory tests was better. So are we going to eat better, or are we going to exercise? Obviously, we're going to do both to the extent that we can. And if a person says, well, I can't exercise, for whatever reason, my weight is too much out of control, I have a disability, we do what we can.
Mm-hmm.
We find ways to make it work as best as we possibly can.
It's interesting about the hippocampus regenerating. I thought that once the brain cell was dead, it was done-ski. Like, it was a cell that could not regenerate.
Yeah, that is what I was taught in medical school as well. And that is largely true. But we do see a certain amount of the brain sort of recapturing old territory.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go ahead and open up the doctor's mailbag, take a couple of questions here with the time that we have remaining. It's funny. Susan was in the chat early. She wanted to know whether a Mediterranean diet could influence Alzheimer's risk. We definitely covered that. Karen has an interesting role here. We talk about preventing infections earlier with the vaccines. Antioxidants, very good for the immune system, keeping you healthy there. Karen's wondering what role they may play in preventing Alzheimer's.
Yeah, antioxidants. There are many, many antioxidants. Some of them like vitamin C, patrol the watery parts of the body, your bloodstream, for example. And then there are others that monitor that monitor the attacks of free radicals in the fatty parts of your body. So there's a fatty layer in every cell membrane in your body, and vitamin E is what protects it. And the Chicago study showed that people who get more vitamin E cut their risk of Alzheimer's by about 50%. Now, that's an observational study. That's not a randomized trial. But if you want to take that to the bank, here's what I would do. I would get some almonds and have about an ounce of them a day. Now, if you're trying to lose weight, nuts are going to get in your way. That's no question. But if that's not a big issue for you, about 1 ounce of almonds in particular provides you that vitamin E you want. Here's what not to do. Don't go to the health food store and say, I just heard on the exam room that vitamin E is going to help me. Well, we've got some vitamin E here for you. It's a little pricey. Don't buy it. Here's why. In nature, there are 8 different forms of vitamin E. In the bottle you buy at the health food store, there might be 1 or 2. The 8 different forms are in a balance. And so if you get almonds or walnuts, something that nature packaged, you're going to get those 8 forms.
Gotcha. Good stuff. Let's talk about something else that you see a lot of in the vitamin store. Those are omega-3s. Barbara wondering what role they may play in terms of reducing Alzheimer's risk. She is asking, though, not necessarily about plant-based sources, but obviously fish.
Yeah.
So if somebody is really eating a fish-heavy diet, are they more likely to develop Alzheimer's? What do we know?
Well, mixed bag for sure. Okay, there are omega-3s in fish. That's good. The fish got them from the algae, and they're parked in their body, and that's a good thing. However, fish have cholesterol. Just like in a fish or an animal, they got skeletal muscle, and so they have cholesterol. They have a substantial amount of saturated fat in addition to some good fat. So if what you're going for is that good fat, don't get it from fish, because the salmon has some good fat, some bad fat, some mercury, some, you know, heavy metals. Don't do that. If you want to take some omega-3, go online and look up vegan omega-3, and you'll find DHA and EPA packed together in a totally clean vegan source. Now, do you need it? Hard to know. Is it going to work for you? Hard to know as well. The literature does not show yet that people who supplement omega-3s reduce their risk of Alzheimer's. We really aren't there. But what has got us concerned is that there is some evidence that people who naturally tend to run low in omega-3 do seem to be at higher risk. So that's got people supplementing. Practical step, here's what you can do. Go online and get a test kit and test yourself. There's one is called Omega Quant. And I'm not suggesting this over any other, but this company, you go online, you order their test kit, it'll arrive in your mail, you prick your finger and you put a drop of blood on a card. You send it to them along with something like $50, and they'll tell you, here's your omega-3 levels. Here's where you are. And then if you're low, you could decide, I will supplement. If you're not low, you can decide, I won't supplement. I'm not suggesting that this is what people should do, but this is a very common way that people say, okay, I don't want to supplement if I don't need it. Maybe this is a way to go about it. And by the way, Chuck, why would people want to avoid supplementing omega-3?
Yeah.
Because we have found evidence that it may cause prostate cancer.
Oh.
Nobody saw this coming.
That's surprising.
Nobody saw this coming. Men who supplement omega-3s have higher risk of prostate cancer.
Interesting.
And we've seen it in study after study. We don't know why, but there it is.
So if not a supplement, give us the healthier sources. If not fish, omega, flaxseed.
I'm not saying that people shouldn't supplement. I mean, they may decide, I'm not as worried about prostate cancer, I'm much more worried about Alzheimer's, you know, maybe I'll play it that way. Everyone's making their own choice. But to tell the honest truth, I think Mother Nature's pharmacy was, if you look at our great ape cousins, they're not taking omega-3 supplements. And they're not eating fish for the most part. A chimpanzee and a bonobo and a gorilla are not, getting Chinook salmon. That's not their thing. What do they eat? Fruit is the main thing they eat. And the second biggest things are leaves and so forth. Okay, take one of those leaves, send it to a lab. And what they'll say to you is about 6 or 7% of its calories are fat, and a surprising percentage of that fat is omega-3.
Hmm.
And because they eat, we eat leaves, a little bit of spinach on the side, and that's it for the week, but our great ape cousins eat a huge amount of them. So the omega-3 content of it is substantial. And because the proportion of it is high, they're not getting much fat, but the fat they are getting is high in omega-3. So it becomes a significant source. Note to self, eat a whole lot more greens.
Good to know. Eat your greens, boys and girls. Something far from greens is sugar. Deborah wondering what the connection between sugar and Alzheimer's could be.
I don't think there's a direct effect. I think that the indirect effect is the sugar on the donut makes you buy it, and all that coconut fat inside is loaded with saturated fat that's going to lead to Alzheimer's.
Let's see. Berries such as blueberries, strawberries, are they beneficial for brain health?
Probably. There were a couple of really cool studies at the University of Cincinnati. Brought in people who were 78 years old, 79, 80 years of age, and already kind of having a little bit of memory issues. And what they gave them was first grape juice. Not any special grape juice, just, Welch's grape juice. You buy it off the shelf, cup in the morning, cup at night, or 2 cups in the morning, but a pint a day. And what they showed is that ability to learn and ability to remember were enhanced within about 90 days. Okay, so this looked good. And the question was, why? It looks like the anthocyanins that make grapes purple, they're a very powerful antioxidant, and it's probably that effect. So to confirm that, the researchers started over, new group of people, similar in age, and this time they said, let's use blueberry juice. Because what it's got in common with grape juice is it's got a whole lot of anthocyanins, and it had exactly the same effect.
Hmm.
And so the good news is it doesn't have to be a fancy one. It can even be a sweetened one. But the thing that matters is the anthocyanins. And anthocyanins are purple. There are also some red ones. So some strawberries on your salad helps as well.
Good idea. All right, let's end with this. We're talking about berries. We got to talk about wine then. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, what impact does red wine or moderate alcohol consumption have on Alzheimer's risk? That comes from Carol.
I got to tell you, Chuck, this has been the biggest debate. I don't think the jury is in yet, but here's the reason it's been a problem. Wine, as you said, comes from grapes and very, very rich in anthocyanins. The red wine, obviously, very rich in anthocyanins. That's good. The alcohol itself is a solvent. It's toxic. The more you drink, the worse it is for your brain. I'll tell you my best guess. My best guess is that alcohol is not going to turn out to be helpful at all in any form. That it's going to be dose related. The more you drink, the more you're going to knock out brain cells. But anthocyanins from any source are going to be helpful to you. So if you got the grape juice before it fermented, you're probably better off.
All right. Dr. Barnard, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff.
I would like to dedicate today's episode to my late mother-in-law, Shelby, who passed away 1 year ago from Alzheimer's this week. Not a single day goes by that we do not laugh and cry and smile thinking about her. And I also want to send a lot of love out to my wife and my father-in-law, who are still mourning the loss to this day. And as anybody who has lost someone near and dear to them knows, it takes a while to grieve these things, even with a long goodbye with a disease like Alzheimer's. So Shelby, this one is for you. And if you are interested in taking your Alzheimer's IQ to the next level, you can see all of our Alzheimer's resources on our website right now, pcrm.org, or just click the link in the episode notes. Now, let's change gears and talk about some big news coming out of the nation's capital here in Washington, D.C., where the FDA is proposing a rule that would require food manufacturers to place nutrition labels on the front of foods and drinks. The goal here is obvious. It's to help people make healthier and more informed decisions. And I gotta tell you, from a personal standpoint, I love this idea a lot. It's used in other countries around the world. Now, these new labels proposed by the FDA would show the amount of saturated fat, sodium, and added sugar in these particular foods and drinks. And additionally, flat out, it's really hard to misinterpret this data because it's going to spell it out, whether it's a low amount, a medium amount, or a high amount, kind of like a traffic light system, you know, green, yellow, and red. And experts say they are hoping that this will help clear up confusion among shoppers who often buy things thinking that they're healthy because of clever packaging that highlights one particular benefit that this food or drink may offer. Take vitamin C, for instance. You can fortify orange soda with vitamin C and make it seem like a health food by touting those high vitamin C levels. But really, all the soda is a sugar bomb in disguise. But these front package labels would clear up that confusion. And the FDA says the labels, they were actually designed after analyzing a study of nearly 10,000 adults to determine how we interpret various nutrition labels. And so they simplified everything with these scores and came up with this system. And if all goes through, you may begin to see these on food packages near you in just a couple of years. So how about that? That is progress, my friends. And if you would like to help our show grow healthier as well, be sure to follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And when you do that, please also leave a 5-star rating. That's how we continue to get our healthy message around the world in front of as many eyes and ears as possible. And as you leave that 5-star rating, why not leave a nice review? Let us know what you love about the show too, what you love about eating a plant-based diet. And we might just feature your review right here on an upcoming episode of The Exam Room. And also, I want to say hi to Cheryl from Mom's Market in Waldorf, Maryland. Bumped into her while I was doing a little bit of shopping recently. She said that she loves the show. And Cheryl, I just wanted to say it was a pleasure to meet you, my friend. Pleasure indeed. Thank you so very much for listening. And for today, that is going to wrap things up. I want to say thank you one more time to Dr. Neil Barnard for being here and educating us and inspiring us as we raise our Alzheimer's and dementia prevention IQs. And for everyone at the Physicians Committee, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll. Thank you so very much for listening. And remember, as always, keep it plant-based.